Chapter 7. Brainwashing and the Sleeping Partner. How or why do we start smoking in the first place? To understand this fully, you need to examine the powerful effect of the subconscious mind, or as I call it, the sleeping partner. We all tend to think we're intelligent, dominant human beings, determining our paths through life. In fact, 99% of our makeup is moulded. We're a product of the society in which we're raised. The sort of clothes we wear, the houses we live in, our basic life patterns, even those matters on which we tend to differ, such as politics. Even in matters of fact, rather than opinion, millions of people can be deluded. Before Columbus sailed to the Americas, the majority of people knew the world to be flat. Today, we know it is round. If I wrote a dozen books trying to persuade you that it was flat, I couldn't do it. Yet how many of us have been into space to see the globe? Even if you've flown or sailed round the world, how do you know that you are not travelling in a circle above a flat surface? Advertisers know well the power of suggestion over the subconscious mind. You think that ads in magazines are a waste of money? That they don't persuade you to buy cigarettes? You're wrong. Try it out for yourself. Next time you go into a bar or restaurant on a cold day and your companion asks you what you're having to drink, instead of saying a brandy or whatever, embellish it with, "Do you know what I would really enjoy today? That marvellous warm glow of a brandy." You'll find that even people who dislike brandy will join you. From our earliest years, our subconscious minds are bombarded daily with messages telling us that cigarettes are the most precious thing on this earth. They relax us and give us confidence and courage. You think I exaggerate? Whenever you see a cartoon, film, or play in which someone is about to be executed or shot, what is often his last request? That's right, a cigarette. The impact of this doesn't register on our conscious minds, but the sleeping partner, our subconscious, has time to absorb it. What the message is really saying is, the most precious thing on this earth, my last thought and action, will be the smoking of a cigarette. In almost every war film, the injured man is given a cigarette. Do you think things have changed recently? No. Our children are still being bombarded by large billboards and magazine advertisements. Cigarette advertising is supposed to be banned on television nowadays, yet during peak viewing hours in Britain, the world's top darts players are seen constantly puffing away. The programmes are usually sponsored by the tobacco giants, and this is the most sinister trend of all in today's advertising. The link with sporting occasions and the jet set. Grand Prix racing cars are modelled and even named after cigarette brand names. Or is it the other way around? I've seen plugs on television depicting a naked couple sharing a cigarette in bed after having sex. The implications are obvious. How my admiration goes out to the advertisers of the small cigar. Not for their motives, but for the brilliance of their campaign. Wherein a man is about to face death or disaster, his balloon is on fire and about to crash, or the sidecar of his motorbike is about to crash into a river, or he's Columbus and his ship is about to go over the edge of the world. Not a word is spoken. Soft music plays. He lights up a cigar. A look of sheer bliss covers his face. The conscious mind may not realize that the smoker is even watching the advertisement, but the sleeping partner is patiently digesting the obvious implications. True, there's publicity the other way. The cancer scares, the legs being amputated, the bad breath campaigns. But these don't actually stop people from smoking. Logically, they should. But the fact is, they don't. They don't even prevent youngsters from starting. All the years that I remained a smoker, I honestly believe that had I known of the links between lung cancer and cigarette smoking, I would never have become a smoker. The truth is that it doesn't make the slightest bit of difference. The trap is the same today as when Sir Walter Raleigh fell into it. All the anti-smoking campaigns just add to the confusion. Even the products themselves, those lovely, shining packs that lure you into trying their contents, contain a deadly warning on their sides. What smoker ever reads it, let alone faces the implications of it? I believe that a leading cigarette manufacturer is actually using the Surgeon General's warning to sell its products. The health warning is now so large and bold that the smoker can't avoid it, however hard he tries. The pang of fear that the smoker suffers prompts him or her to reach for the glossy pack. Ironically, the most powerful force in this brainwashing is the smoker himself. It's a fallacy that smokers are weak-willed or physically weak. You have to be physically strong in order to cope with the poison. This is one of the reasons why smokers refuse to accept the overwhelming statistics that prove that smoking cripples your health. Everyone knows of an Uncle Fred who smoked 40 a day, never had a day's illness in his life, and lived to 80. Smokers refuse to even consider the hundreds of other smokers who are cut down in their prime, or the fact that Uncle Fred might still be alive if he hadn't been a smoker. If you do a small survey among your friends and colleagues, you'll find that most smokers are, in fact, strong-willed people. They tend to be self-employed, business executives, or in specialized professions such as doctors, lawyers, policemen, teachers, salesmen, nurses, secretaries, housewives with children. In other words, anybody leading a stressful existence. The main delusion of smokers is that smoking relieves stress and tends to be associated with the dominant type, the type that takes on responsibility in stress. And of course, that is the type we admire and therefore tend to copy. Another group that tends to get hooked is people in monotonous jobs, because the other main reason for smoking is boredom. However, the idea that smoking relieves boredom is also an illusion, I'm afraid. The extent of the brainwashing is quite incredible. As a society, we get all uptight about glue sniffing, heroin addiction, and other drug addictions. Actual deaths from glue sniffing don't amount to 100 per annum. And deaths from heroin are no more than several hundred a year in England, for example. There is another drug, nicotine, on which more than 60% of us become hooked at some time in our lives, and the majority spend the rest of their lives paying for it through the nose. Most of their spare money goes towards cigarettes, and hundreds of thousands of people have their lives ruined every year because they became hooked. It is the number one killer in society. Why is it that we regard glue sniffing and heroin addiction as such great evils, while the drug that we spend most of our money on and is actually killing us, we, until recently, regarded as a perfectly acceptable social habit? In recent years, it has been considered a slightly unsociable habit that may injure your health, but it's legal and on sale in glossy packs in newsstands, bars, clubs and restaurants. The biggest vested interest in Britain is the government. It makes £8 billion per year from smokers, and the tobacco companies spend over £100 million per year in promotion alone. You need to start building resistance to this brainwashing, just as if you were buying a car from a second-hand dealer. You would be nodding politely, but you wouldn't believe a word the man was saying. Start looking at the filth and poison beneath these glossy packs. Don't be fooled by the cut glass ashtrays, the gold lighter, or the millions who've been conned. Start asking yourself, why am I doing it? Do I really need to? No, of course you don't. I find this brainwashing aspect the most difficult of all to explain. Why is it that an otherwise rational, intelligent human being becomes a complete imbecile about his own addiction? It pains me to confess that out of the thousands of people I've assisted in kicking the habit, I was the biggest idiot of all. Not only did I reach 100 a day myself, but my father was a heavy smoker. He was a strong man, cut down in his prime due to smoking. I can remember watching him when I was a boy. He would be coughing and spluttering in the mornings. I could see he wasn't enjoying it, and it was obvious to me that something evil had gotten possession of him. I can remember saying to my mother, "Don't ever let me become a smoker." At the age of 15, I was a physical fitness fanatic. Sports were my life. I was full of courage and confidence. If anybody had said to me in those days that I would end up smoking 100 cigarettes a day, I would have gambled my lifetime's earnings that it wouldn't happen, and I would have given any odds that had been asked. By the age of 40, I was a physical and mental cigarette junkie. I'd reached the stage where I couldn't carry out the most mundane physical or mental act without first lighting up. With most smokers, the triggers are the normal stresses of life, like answering the telephone or socializing. I couldn't even change a television channel or a light bulb without lighting up. I knew it was killing me. There was no way I could kid myself otherwise. But I can't understand why I couldn't see what it was doing to me mentally. It was almost jumping up and biting me on the nose. The ridiculous thing is that most smokers suffer the delusion at some time in their life that they enjoy a cigarette. I never suffered that delusion. I smoked because I thought it helped me concentrate, and because it helped my nerves. Now that I'm a non-smoker, the most difficult part is trying to believe that those days actually happened. It's like awakening from a nightmare, and that's about the size of it. Nicotine is a drug, and your senses are drugged. Your taste buds, your sense of smell. The worst aspect of smoking isn't the injury to your health or pocket, it's the warping of the mind. You search for any plausible excuse to go on smoking. I remember at one stage switching to a pipe after a failed attempt to kick cigarettes, in the belief that it was less harmful and would cut down my intake. Some of those pipe tobaccos are absolutely foul. The aroma can be pleasant, but they're awful to smoke. I can remember that for about 3 months, the tip of my tongue was as sore as a boil. A liquid brown goo collects in the bottom of the pipe bowl. Occasionally, you unwittingly bring the bowl above the horizontal, and before you realize it, you've swallowed a mouthful of the filthy stuff. The result is that you usually throw up immediately, no matter whose company you're in. It took me 3 months to learn to cope with the pipe, but what I can't understand is why I didn't sit down sometime during that 3 months and ask myself why I was subjecting myself to the torture. Of course, having learned to cope with the pipe, no one appears more contented than pipe smokers. Most of them are convinced that they smoke because they enjoy the pipe. But why did they have to work so hard to learn to like it when they were perfectly happy without it? The answer is that once you've become addicted to nicotine, the brainwashing is increased. Your subconscious mind knows that the little monster has to be fed, and you block everything else from your mind. As I've already stated, it's fear that keeps people smoking, the fear of that empty, insecure feeling that comes when you stop supplying the nicotine. Because you're not aware of it doesn't mean it isn't there. You don't have to understand it any more than a cat needs to understand where the underfloor hot water pipes are. The cat just knows that if it sits in a certain place, it gets a feeling of warmth. It's the brainwashing that is the main difficulty in giving up smoking. The brainwashing of our upbringing in society, reinforced with the brainwashing from our own addiction, and, most powerful of all, the brainwashing of our friends, relatives, and colleagues. Did you notice that up to now, I frequently refer to giving up smoking? I used the expression at the beginning of the previous paragraph. This is a classic example of the brainwashing. The expression implies a genuine sacrifice. The beautiful truth is that there is absolutely nothing to give up. On the contrary, you'll be freeing yourself from a terrible disease and achieving marvelous positive gains. We're going to start removing this brainwashing now. From this point on, no longer will we refer to giving up, but to stopping, quitting, or the true position, escaping. The only thing that persuades us to smoke in the first place is all the other people doing it. We feel we're missing out. We work so hard to become hooked, yet nobody ever finds out what he or she has been missing. But every time we see another smoker, he reassures us that there must be something in it. Otherwise, he wouldn't be doing it. Even when he's kicked the habit, the ex-smoker feels he's being deprived when a smoker lights up at a party or other social function. He feels safe. He can have just one. And before he knows it, he's hooked again. This brainwashing is very powerful, and you need to be aware of its effects. Many older smokers in Britain remember the Paul Temple detective series, a very popular radio show after World War II. One of the episodes dealt with addiction to marijuana. Unbeknownst to the smoker, wicked men were selling cigarettes that contained pot. There were no harmful effects. People merely became addicted and had to go on buying the cigarettes. During my consultations, literally hundreds of smokers have admitted to trying pot. None of them said they became hooked on it. I was about 7 years old when I listened to the program. It was my first knowledge of drug addiction. The concept of addiction, being compelled to go on taking the drug, filled me with horror, and even to this day, in spite of the fact that I'm fairly convinced that pot is not addictive, I wouldn't dare to take one puff of marijuana. How ironic that I should have ended up a junkie on the world's number one addictive drug. If only Paul Temple had warned me about the cigarette itself. How ironic, too, that more than 60 years later, mankind spends millions on cancer research, yet many millions more are spent persuading healthy teenagers to become hooked on the filthy weed, with government having the largest vested interest. We're about to remove the brainwashing. It's not the non-smoker who's being deprived, but the poor smoker who is forfeiting a lifetime of health, energy, wealth, peace of mind, confidence, courage, self-respect, happiness, and freedom. And what does the smoker gain from these considerable sacrifices? Absolutely nothing, except the illusion of trying to get back to the state of peace, tranquility, and confidence that the non-smoker enjoys all the time.